It's a story unlike any other in English football, and now we're going to tell it. Welcome to The Blueprint. From Premier League also-rans in 1992, fast forward 20 years and Chelsea were being crowned Europe's finest. The Blues were defeating Bayern Munich, a German powerhouse, on penalties to win the Champions League and in Bayern's own backyard, no less. We know football throws up all sorts of narratives, but for Chelsea, theirs is one that has left a lasting legacy. For the club, for English football, for the European game. And that's what this narrative podcast series is all about. We're telling the inside story of how Chelsea did it all. We've spoken to over 180 people on and off the record for The Blueprint. From the executives in the boardroom to the players in the dressing room and the fans on the terraces. The Blueprint is the definitive forensic story of modern Chelsea. And we're kicking things off with a two-part special before the full series drops in May 2023. Ken Bates doesn't give interviews much these days. In fact, he doesn't do documentaries. In spite of all that, he sat down with us in Monaco to give his perspective on his reign at Chelsea Football Club. With the Mediterranean lapping behind him, helicopters flying along the coastline as they transported the Monte Carlo elite, he gave us hours of his time and valuable insight into his Chelsea world. And what you're about to hear is the result. Bates reveals all about how he saved Chelsea from financial ruin, how one fan's jibe inspired him to create the Chelsea pitch owners, his strained relationship with Matthew Harding, and perhaps most importantly, takes us inside the deal of selling the club to Roman Abramovich. I'm Kerry Levy, and I'll be your guide throughout this journey. At times, you will hear another voice, and that's Gary Hayes. Gary and I have spent 8 years piecing this story together. And it will be released very soon. So subscribe to The Blueprint wherever you get your podcasts. But until then, sit back and listen as Ken Bates brings us inside Chelsea like never before.
So Ken, just to get us started, to talk about the history of English football, where was English football in 1992, when the Premier League came to be?
Football gradually grew, came to Football League, and it finished up with 92 members in four divisions. Originally, it was League One, League Two, League Three North, League Three South. But when it became a bit more organised and had meetings, they said, no, if this is a national league, it's got to be a national league. So then you got three and four. Now, what had happened was there was a lot of animosity between the FA and between the Football League, have a power on this and that and the other. You don't know what goes on behind the scenes. I did in the end, because I became a chairman of a few companies, committees, and I was on the FA Council and on the FA Board. But it's also petty. But what you really have, what really changes is that you, by and large, you've got people who are in football, or were, because they love the game, starting with the local school team, church team, and it gradually evolved more and more. But they're ordinary little businessmen, one hour, that had been disrespectful, who gave their time part-time to run their club, but it was left to the manager and the secretary. But they were arguing with the FA, and the FA were not much better. So the FA came up with the idea that they would be clogged down and we were killing, competing internationally, that had just been invented. So they wanted their own league. So they approached the First Division of the Football League and had surreptitious discussions at the top few, a bit like what's going on now. And to cut a long story short, in the end, they agreed to break away. It was originally called the FA Premier League. And you, of course, when the Premier League started getting too big for its boots, they dropped the FA bit. And as you know, you've had several efforts led by David Dean and others to form the Super League. And I managed to kill both those off. Oh, Martin Edwards wanted to negotiate his own TV deal like they do in Europe. And I'm saying to him, well, what about us? He said, you can do your own TV deal. And I said, well, what about the gate money? He said, well, each home club keeps their own gate. I said, if you think I'm going to bring my Chelsea team up for nothing, you're bigger what's it than I think you are. I said, right, we will play you under your scheme and we'll come up and all my team will get dressed and change and sit in the dressing room and I will sit with them until your bank manager brings us a Barclays bank draft for our half of the gate and the television receipts and the programme sales. Dead silence. That was never discussed again. I would stack up the small clubs. Football is a pyramid. It's all about the little clubs at the bottom. When I took over Oldham, it was a bit of a mess. I spent £50,000 in 3 weeks, which was a fortune in 1965. And we took a 16-year-old kid on the office boy. And he had a call. He said, Chairman, he said, I've just had a call from the printer. Do you want your usual 2,000 season tickets printed separately in two batches? Well, Frank Buckley, who was the secretary and in charge of all that, had taken his holidays at a different time. So the printer didn't get the instructions that he should have got. I got the club secretary 6 months in jail. He printed these 2,000 tickets in parallel with the official 2,000 tickets and flung them on the side. And I called the police and couldn't have ever heard it. The old establishment manager directors were appalled and they all gave character references for him in his trial. That 16-year-old kid, named Bernard Holford, finished up being life president of Manchester City because he went to City, he was headhunted there, revolutionised it. When the Arabs bought the city, they said, he's staying. He used to do after-dinner speeches and apparently he told me, I didn't know, his favourite story was me. I got rid of Buckley, he said, I came in, chairman chucked the keys at me, he said, are you in charge now? This is 17. You're in charge. He said to the head groundsman, hey, and you're in charge of all the gates, turnstiles, that kind of thing. And said to, God, my name, no, dead. Simply said, if anybody had not got a ticket, they do not get in. If Jesus Christ comes in without a ticket, chuck him out. And that's how I've run all my businesses, all my club.
So in 1992, when the Premier League was formed, could you just explain where Chelsea were and what the situation was with the club?
No, everybody had their say. And I simply pointed out, had to be equal. 22, and we are equal. They said, oh, we want to cut it down to 20. I said, OK, well, Manchester United and Arsenal, why don't you leave? That was not the response they were expecting. Well, two stories about TV. First of all, I was responsible for smashing, with Robert Maxwell, smashing the illegal criminal breach of the Monopolies Act and Commission. ITV and BBC did a deal. They put a joint bid in for the TV rights and split the difference and shared that equally. The commercial committee, they're dumb eggs. They were elected by football people of football people. Now it's run the other way. Places full of people who know nothing about football, but still. So the commercial committee was basically, you vote for me and I'll vote for you and I'll appoint you. So Robert Maxwell and Irving Scholar, we formed a subcommittee. We used to meet at Bob's office, penthouse office, with sandwiches, champagne, to decide what should really be done, then push it through if we could at the meeting. This particular one, we're coming on about this bloody monopoly. Now, by that time, don't forget, Maxwell was an MP and of a rather dominated character with a strong, piercing voice, which tended to catch your attention. So he rang up the Attorney General. He said, aren't you aware that a company wholly owned by the government are breaking their own laws? He said, what are you talking about? So he told him, Look at that. Caused consternation. 2 months later, the so-called tender process was withdrawn. ITV got on the bandwagon, obviously Unlimited. I think they were paying us $3 million a year between them. And I think ITV, was it Greg Dyke? He upped it to $4 million. It was a bloody disgrace. Sky had just started. Murdoch took over two disused warehouses and hangars in Isleworth and started Sky Television. Oh, what was the other fellow's name who come to me? He used to run the TV, so who was his number two? Aussie boy. Put the Sky deal through. Sam Chisholm. Anyway, ITV kept the deal. I think they paid £11 million. Everybody went bloody apeshit. Chelsea never got a game live on TV because you used to get appearance money. Never got live on TV until 2 months before the end of the contract when Greg Dyke, we met in the grill at the Savoy. And Greg Dyke said, oh, I think we just get them on, can't we? Yeah, of course we can. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, I've been negotiating with Sky. And again, cut long story, by this time, Ron Nodgers, he and I, like that. Great man. We arranged to seal the deal, and it was arranged on, we'd meet on the Sunday morning in Murdoch's penthouse apartment overlooking St. James's Park, near the Ritz. I went out the farm door in Beaconsfield, where we lived, and I said to Susanna, who'd been in the business, and she was a sports writer, an independent sports writer, didn't trust editors. Anyway, I was going out, I shouted out, I thought 20 million would beat the 11. But I walked on impulse, I shouted out, I'm going to ask for 30. Turned around and walked towards my Bentley across the gravel. And a rather loud voice shouted, no, make it 50. And I went, ah. Walked, crunched across the gravel, got in the car door, started up, going down the drive. I'm thinking, I'd love 50. Bloody stupid, ask for 50. Ask for 50. By the time I got to the drive, which was 1.5 miles, the main road, 1.5 miles down the drive, I said, 50? 50? By the time I got to the Ritz, I stormed in, felt a very gentle, oh, nice to meet you, Mr. Brown. I said, we want 50 million. Stunned and silence. Because Murdoch was on the same situation as Maxwell, insolvency. So I remember Murdoch. He gulped and went white. And he said, I'm sure we can work a deal out and get up to that. I said, no, 50 a year, every year, starting now, for 3 years. There was a dead silence. Did you ever meet Sam Chisholm? Big burly guy.
He was the guy charged with implementing all this with... For Murdoch, wasn't he?
He broke the deadly silence. Did the deal.
And this was for the Premier League TV rights? Mm.
So the deal was announced, blah, 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 blah. And about 3 weeks after it was announced, they announced pay-per-view. Pay, what was that? I've got my licence. Yeah, but your licence went to the BBC. Anyway, this debate was taking place. And Susanna always interrupts at the most appropriate time. So what are they moaning about? There's a million guys... Every Saturday, whatever the weather, put their raincoat, get their umbrella, walk out, and they go to the grounds. And they buy a ticket and go through a turnstile. Well, isn't that pay-per-view? Which is perfectly true. So the argument against pay-per-view collapsed dramatically.
What was your ambition for Chelsea at this point? Because when you took over, there was so much you did in the 80s to stabilise the club. And as we came into the 90s... Bobby Campbell had got the team promoted again in 89, and then 89-90, the club finished fifth, had a really good season. If it wasn't for the ban with European teams, Chelsea would have been back in Europe. The team was gradually moving forward, and it was this new dawn, the Premier League. What was going on behind the scenes with you at Chelsea in terms of what you were trying to do to make Chelsea...
I was just trying to do the same with Chelsea that every other chairman was trying to do with their club. I mean, Chelsea had always been the poor relations of London, the big poor relations of London. You know how Chelsea started?
Well, how it was formed?
Hmm.
Across the street, 10th of March, 1905.
No, the circumstances surrounding the occasion. Mears was a big family company. They used to be big Ford main contractors, Mears, near Kingston. And they had another mother business as well. It was a little family empire. But the big thing was Mears Brothers Contractors. And they were very big sand and gravel merchants and builders and contractors. And to need a big building that thorough, you needed to make concrete. It's been obvious now, isn't it? But so you'd sand, gravel, and cement. Forget the niceties of reinforcement, that kind of stuff. Sophistication. And so Mears Brothers owned a ballast pit, one of the biggest in London. You ever heard of a place called Fulham Road? They had the biggest bloody ballast pit in London. And it stretched from there, over either side of Fulham Road, it stretched all the way up to where Old Court Station is now. And of course, when they put the railway line in, that was an old ballast pit. And because it was all near the River Thames, it was all part of the River Thames estuary, which goes right down to the sea, goes up past Oxford. So it was a whole gravel pit area, if you know what I mean. What you do with a gravel pit? Good place to put the rubbish. Right, we're taking the sand out, flogged it, made a fortune. But what were we going to do with it? Hey, Fulham's on the river. Poxy little ground, as it was then. Wonder if they'd like to... £1,000 a year rent. And the then Fulham owner said, told him, go forth and multiply. So my brother said, all right, we'll form our own. And that's how Chelsea Football Club, Chelsea Football and Athletic Company Limited, was formed. And that was 1905. And the Football League were looking to grow. So they invited applications. I think they put in a good application, you know, look where we are, look this, look that, look the other side. They went in, without kicking a ball. Just as I did at St. Miletus. 50 odd years earlier. Bates leads, others follow.
In 1992, there was a big challenge that had been going on since you bought Chelsea. And it's to do with the freehold of the stadium.
Well, what had happened? I mean, Chelsea was skint. It was literally 24 hours from going bust. The circumstances were, they just played Tottenham in the Cup. In those days, it was one-third the home team, one-third the away team, one-third into the pot for distribution of gate receipts. And on Thursday afternoon or Friday, the bank manager had enough, and he rang up, he said, I've got two cheques in my in-tray, 40-odd thousand each, one's for the players' wages, one's for the FA, which one shall I bounce? And Martin Spencer said, bounce the players' wages, because if we bounce the FA one, this was before I was there, bounce the FA one, we'd be finished. So they did. They'd been negotiating, trying to find a buyer, and I came in as the only buyer. They wanted £300,000 that day. So we met on the Friday in their lawyer's offices. We're haggling over this and haggling over that, haggling over the other. There were David Mears, Brian Mears and Lord Chelsea, who is now the Earl of Cadogan, who were not forthcoming with much money, as were not the landed gentry in those days. I mean, David Mears, can I keep me Volvo? Can I keep me 12,000 years? Can I keep the two tickets in the director's box for my auntie, my mother-in-law? And we were dragging out. If I said, look, he said, we can't finish this tonight. Boy, put your 3,000, the 100,000 in now. We'll finalise it next week. What's that great phrase? I know it might be stupid, but I'm not that stupid. I said, Mr. Mears, if you think I'm going to put £300,000 unsecured into your bank account under your control to the man who's got the club in this state, you might wish to bleep the next bit. I say, you must be a bigger than I think you are. There was a slight silence, and the Earl of Cadogan said, well, I've agreed the deal and I'm signing it, because his name anyway. So he signed it and tossed it across the table. So Dave Byamere signed it. And David Mears signed it. So I got my deal. Picked up and walked out. Oh, and as we're walking out, Lord Chelsea, gracious gentleman he was, said, oh, Ken, may I call you Ken? I said, please. You should have called me Chairman, but I didn't want to tell him. He said, would you like to be my guest at the game tomorrow and have lunch beforehand? I could have played poker, I'm told. My face didn't move a muscle. I thought, this guy is inviting me to be a guest at my club. I said, very gracious of him, my lord. Thank you very much indeed. What time shall I come? That's how it started.
When you bought the club, though, the stadium was
The whole thing is they've been hocking everything in sight. So finally, the bank were putting the boot in once again. So Martin Spencer, who's a chartered accountant, and they brought him in to run the club because he was actually a receiver and administrator. That was his forte. So he did a sale and lease back on the club, on the ground, which was, I can't remember the name now, coming to us during the conversation. It was bought by a property, Marlow Estates. It was bought by a property company already, shifted them out across the most valuable piece of land in London. 12.5 acres of land, 2 miles from Piccadilly Circus. What would the houses go for? What would the office block go for? So there was a constant fight the next day to get us out. And behind the scenes was David Mears, because he also had shares in Marlow Estates, and they tried to negotiate behind my back to ground share with Crystal Palace. That's how I got to know Von Nodes, who marked my cards. What's this about you ground share? It was a reserve match. Club chairman from other clubs, London club, used to go and watch Spurs. And I was in one sat next to me, introduced himself to me. He said, what's this about you ground sharing with Palace? I said, what are you talking about? Then he turned around, he'd had Mears, the two Mears, a lawyer, and Lord Chelsea negotiating a 20-year deal. And they pay us £1 million to go.
Can you just tell us what your response to Ron Nodes was when he told you this?
I don't be bloody stupid. I said, next home game. And I was in the director's cloakroom, doing what directors do in cloakrooms, officially. And I said to him, I think you better leave, David. Well, what are you talking about? I said, well, if I go out on that loudspeaker and make that statement to the crowd, a leper will be more welcome in this place than you. Get out. I need the keys of your car behind. And that's how the war started.
I don't know how you date, but the 15th of December 1992, do you know why that day is significant in Chelsea history? It's the day that you got the freehold back for the stadium.
Oh, yeah. Oh, silly me. A passing incident in the club's fantastic history.
But there was something that you created as a result of that as well, with the CPO.
Now, I think I bought it, and it was announced the day of an evening game. And it was after the game, and he had to walk out the director's box, go back to the offices, and the East End. And it was dark, but there's always a crowd around there. Not as bad, we won. And a voice shouted out, yeah, that's all right, Batesy. What are you going to do when your grandson flogs the bloody ground for houses? I walked in a statesman-like fashion, ignoring him completely. You ungrateful But the more I walked up the set, I thought, he's right. He's right. David Mears. And of course, I spent 9 or 10 years in Lancashire, where the national anthem was, rags to riches to rags in 3 generations. Because what happens is, you know, a guy starts with nothing. His kids have nothing. So he works his guts out, becomes a successful businessman, and he gives his kids everything then he never had to make up for their loss for him. So the kid takes it for granted. So then he has kids and he gives his kids the life he'd been used to. So that kid, the grandson, the third generation, rags to riches to rags in 3 generations. And I thought, bloody right. There's a will, there's a way, there's always a way around it. And I spent 7 years in Ireland and I like the Irish, despite my many battles with them. And the Irish also are a very family country. I don't know if you know what I mean.
My mum's Irish.
Wife's Irish.
I'll moderate my language. But the thing, no matter where they go in the world, I mean, the Brits conquered the world, as we all know. But in fact, the Irish, and to a lesser extent, the Scots did most of the work. And they never forgot the home. This guy came up with the idea. He bought a field, 4 acres, about 2 or 3 miles north of Dublin. I think he was living in Australia or somewhere like that. Anyway, he chopped the field up into 1 square foot patches and flogged them off for £100 a patch. Own a piece of the old sod, O-U-L-D, as you know the spelling, since you're Irish, S-O-D, sod of earth. Yeah, by 4 acres. Now I'll take the whole of bloody Stamford Bridge, chop it up into square foot, own a piece of Stamford Bridge. I've done my calculation, but I can't really do it. It's 4,840 square feet to an acre, I think. So you're looking at 4,16, probably 18,000 square feet, undercut each, 18,000, and 1.8 million. Woohoo! 1.8 million into the club, eh? That's a lot of money those days. 2 days later, a phone call from a lawyer. Kent, got a problem with the flogging the land. What's that? Well, he says £100 a square foot. Oh, yep. It's a land transaction, so you've got to charge £117.5 VAT. So the £100 is now £117.5. Oh, that's not the end of it. When you're in central London to the land registry office, you've got to pay a duty. I can't remember what it was now, but say it was £100. That means I had to pay, sorry, £10, pay another £180,000. I said, so of your 100 quid, you're now down to 62 and a half, less a tenner, 52 and a half. He said, I haven't finished. You'll have been a very successful businessman. You've paid your VAT. You paid your ground registry. You've got to pay corporation tax on what's left. So if you're 100 quid, you'll get about 35, 40. Oh, putting the phone down, gently. I've always found a way around. Where there's a problem, there's an answer. It's the failures that use it as an excuse. So that's when I came up with CPO, Chelsea Pitch Owners. So I'll sell the ground. So Chelsea Pitch Owners will acquire the ground. But where do you have any money? I'd had the money because I just raised 75 million quid. So I granted Chelsea Pitch Owners. Yes. £1 a year. But I also granted them, I sold them the ownership of the name, Chelsea Football Club Limited, untransferable and not saleable. But then I put another clause in, no matter how many shares you buy, you only get one vote, which buggered up Mr. Obama, which is, though I never knew about it till afterwards, but they tried to buy, take over Chelsea Pitch Owners. That blocking vote killed it. They're now talking, they've been talking about now, the new owners will build a magnificent new stadium. Well, the trouble is all these people that talk, they're not practical people, but I've done everything. I've done trenches in the rain, 6 foot in the morning, watching fill up with bloody water. I'm a practical man as well as a businessman. And I saw these drawings, but all these drawings and designs, all done by professionals who will not have to do the work. And I reckon it would take 5 to 7 years to redevelop Stamford Bridge in the way they bought the ground out. And I got planning permission from the council, which has now lapsed. And they only just realised a kick in the tail. Chelsea Football Club plays at Stamford Bridge. So they're still puzzling over that one.
Do you think that what you did there with CPO will save Chelsea then, has saved Chelsea times since as well?
Well, it will save the name. What are they going to call it? Neasden Athletic? They were trying to get Battersea, and Abramovich was beaten out bid for Battersea. Battersea Wharf FC, doesn't the same thing to it, does it?
What you did was you gave control to the fans. So the fans control the club in a way that no other fans do in the Premier League, at least.
No, they don't. The fans, our fans, they support the club. And they've leased it to this company called Chelsea Football Club. They don't have any shares in Chelsea Football Club. In fact, one of the stipulations was they couldn't buy Chelsea Football Club.
To talk more football matters, how important was the appointment of Glenn Hoddle to changing things on the pitch for Chelsea?
Well, at the time, Chelsea was a buggered. And although I put quite a bit of money in it, I didn't have the kind of money needed to run a club, needed to finance a club. It had to pay on its own. If I wanted a first division club, I wanted a first division manager. And I had a few. Bobby Campbell did a good job, but he reached the level of his abilities. We were very good friends. He was a true scouser. I will say no more. And I thought, no, let's go for somebody. And I can't remember who the idea came, Hoddle. Now, Hoddle was a brilliant player. There's no doubt about that. He was a genius. But he wasn't a leader. And never won anything except promotion for Swindon Town, and then into the First Division. And so on the strength of that, I worked really hard, summoned BS and got him. And he took the job. We wasn't a leader, didn't inspire.
So did you see that firsthand?
We were in danger of relegation under his managership. I think it was the first year we were down in Southampton. We had three games over Christmas, and we were down at Southampton at Christmas Day. We were losing 1-0. And Dennis Wise was the captain. And apparently Hoddle came and said, "All right, everything's okay. Keep playing." And Dennis Wise lost his temper. He turned around and kicked the bloody bench, which passed for chairs in those days. And banged the bloody, "No, we're not effing all right. We're bloody useless. We're going to get effing relegated. What, we're going to go out and kick arse and take them on?" Instead of playing patty ball, patty ball. Everybody said yes. They all got behind Dennis. "Yeah, he's going to sort them out." And so Glenn led the team out in silence.
But Chelsea did get to the FA Cup final that year as well.
We lost 4-0.
But there was gradual changes that Glenn was bringing in, would you argue, that didn't have an immediate effect, but there you could see a change?
Yes, but you don't have an immediate effect. It's like your body. It changes. You don't know overnight unless you have a stroke or something. I mean, Hoddle was all bring the ball down and twist and turn. But his purchase of players reflected his attitude.
Yeah, he signed the likes of Mark Steen, Paul Furlong, John Spencer, Gavin Peacock, but then Rud Hullett. Rud Hullett was a big signing.
But Hullett was a leader. Glenn was a busted flush.
So what was Glenn like to work with then? So he had a lot of demands. He was a very demanding person, demanding manager.
No, he was very quiet and, you know. But what has he done since?
With Glenn and his, what he was bringing with Chelsea, a lot of the players who we've spoken to or just people talk of that era, they say that he did a lot of simple things at Harlington, like he brought in different diet, you know, regimes for the players that they think...
But he'd lived, he'd worked on the continent.
So do you think that was a benefit of having Glenn around, the way that he approached the game? Not necessarily the way that the team played, but what he did behind the scenes, do you think that had an effect?
The effect in a football club is 4:40 on a Saturday afternoon. What was the bottom line? We lost more gracefully than any other time in Chelsea's history. And then Harding came in on the scene, who sucked up to Hoddle like da-da-da-da-da. Then he had an unofficial management team down at where we used to play, Harlington. And he and Hutchinson and Harding, one other name, which we used to meet to discuss the future of Chelsea. Meanwhile, the FA were looking for a manager. So we arranged to have a meeting with his agent, Dennis Roach, and we had a working breakfast at Chelsea Harbour Hotel to thrash out Glenn's new contract. So we agreed, shook hands. 2 o'clock that afternoon, I got a phone call from Glenn Hoddle saying, "Chairman, I've decided to take the English job, so I'm resigning." Oh, I said, "Don't worry, Glenn, I knew you'd taken it at 8 o'clock this morning." Dead silence. So I wished him luck and f***ed him off. 5 o'clock that afternoon, I got a phone call from Graham Kelly. "Can I have permission to approach Glenn Hoddle and interview him with a view to the English job?" I said, "Graham, you've been doing it for 6 months, haven't you? I've known all the time." I said, "Anyway, you're late asking for permission to approach him," because he agreed. He rang me at 2 o'clock to tell me he agreed to take the job. So I said, "Graham, there's one question, can I ask you?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Can I refer you to rule so and so and so and so and so and so? Come on here now." He said, "Yeah, okay, what is it?" I said, "Do you know what it knows, what it says?" He said, "No, not offhand." I said, "It says that if anybody makes an illegal approach to another player's manager or player without the previous manager's approval, they should be reported to the FA for suitable punishment. Who do I ring up in the FA to report that you have just confirmed you've been making legal approaches to my manager? dead silence. You know, Graham used to stutter a lot. I said, think about it, Graham, and give me your answer later, please.
What was the eventual answer?
Didn't get one.
Coming up in the next episode, Ken Bates tells us all about his relationship with Matthew Harding and how he sold the club to Roman Abramovich.
Hodgson, what interest? Dead silence. So I looked at Matthew, raised my eyebrows. Matthew looked down and said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. I've always remembered that phrase.
So is that something you'd say you regret?
Yeah, because it created an ongoing problem with the fans. I mean, this thing about he put £26 million in the club, absolute rubbish. He built the ground, absolute rubbish. Oh, Matthew tried everything. People put private eyes on me. He said to me, I've got somebody who'll pay £140 million for the club. And I suggest you take it. I recommend you take it. It was a famous promise. Well, he wasn't famous in those days. I'm the man who made him famous.
The Blueprint will be back soon. The Blueprint has been written and produced by Gary Hayes and me, Kerry Levy. Our theme music, Blue Day 23, was composed by Mike Canaris with bed arrangements by Jake Bradford Sharp and is used under license from Macasso Music. Vocals are by the Blueprinters, Alison Bender, Chiara Cervazio, Karen Edith Miller, Louis Beneventi, Daniel Childs, and Gary and myself. Leon Radchinsky-Gorman has mixed the series and Mark Jardine is our designer. Consultant producers for the series are Nick Lapworth, Neil Pacchietto and Jackie Anklin. We would also like to thank Gary Link from The Missing Link, Taylor Hayes and everyone who has spoken to us for this series, on and off the record. If you like this series, please share it with your friends and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to another Highway 61 production. For more podcasts like this one, visit www.highway61.media. That's HWY61.media.